Hey, welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And, oh, wow, is there a story behind this book? And I am so happy to welcome Yasmin Engo to Joy on Paper to talk about her newest book. But we're also going to talk about some of her other books because she is a fabulous writer. She's Anthony-nominated author of a wonderful series called Nina Knight, an Assassin. And I can tell you that series is great. I'm so happy to welcome you to the show, Yasmin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is fantastic. Now, the new book, What She Seems, and it's different from... We have to talk about Knight at some point, but this is a domestic thriller, so you're taking us away from the life of an assassin, although I must say that Jacinda Brody has a little bit of her nature in it because she understands revenge, right?
Yes.
It's a completely different scenario. We are now in South Carolina, and it's a different, the whole storyline is different. But you managed to capture a little bit of that, which I love.
Thank you. Thank you. It was difficult, but I had a good time trying to capture a little bit of that and shift from Nina Knight and international espionage thrillers to a more domestic, smaller kind of thriller.
Nina Knight is my favorite assassin, other than the Jackal, maybe. But she's my favorite female assassin, let's put it that way.
Thank you. You said the Jackal, so the Jackal, that's top notch. That's one of my faves, too. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about when I was reading that series. I kept saying, oh my goodness, step aside, Jackal. We got somebody new in town. So we'll talk about that after we talk about this book. I tell you, Not What She Seems. The prologue to this book is so good. I read it, I don't know, I think I've read it 3-4 times now. It is one of the best prologues I have ever read.
Really? Thank you. Wow. Okay.
And I've read a lot. I've read over 10,000 books, so I can tell you, I've read a lot of prologues. I just fell in love with Montavious Brody Sr.
Yeah.
Wow. What a guy.
Thank you.
Just that character alone, as I was reading it, we're going to talk, of course, the star of the book was Jacinda, but Montavious, I was thinking as I finished it and then I went back again, when I finished the book, I went back to that prologue again. And then a couple of times after I'd read the book, I went back to that and I kept saying, I want you to do prequels to this book. I want the Montavious story.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I love him too. And he really has a serious impact throughout the whole story. So I really appreciate you really enjoying the prologue and saying how much you loved it and it was one of your faves. Because I did put a lot into the prologue and I wanted him to make a lasting impression on the reader. The same as what he would do with Jack and the family. He's a very strong figure. And even however, I'm not trying to spoil it, but however long we see him or whatever in the book, I want him to make that lasting impression. So hearing you say that that's the best because I absolutely loved him as well.
Sometimes a character will stand out in a book. You always have the main character. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But sometimes a character who might not have the biggest part in a book sticks out in your mind for so long after I finished the book, I was still going back in my mind thinking, you put in that prologue so much richness. Here, I will just explain. He's the grandfather in the story, and he is an elderly gentleman, and he's on a computer, which I love because there are so many older people in this. People always think it's only the young kids on the computers, but for so many older people, that computer has really changed their life. They can be involved. They can be connected. And he is. And so you get such a kick out of an old man, a very old man, sitting there over a computer, connecting with the world, doing research, his mind active. I think that just that alone set the book on a different level. I just loved him.
Thank you. Thank you. Did everything that I wanted him to do for you. Thank you.
He did. He did. And I have a few. Now that I've said the word prequel, it's going to be in your head. So you know that we have to go back. I can see a couple of different stages in his life. So I think you have two more books just doing the stages of his life, which will be fun. But we'll get to the story. It's based in South Carolina, which is so funny. My girlfriend just finished building a house in South Carolina. So she said, you have to come over. And she's on one of these islands. You have to go across the bridge and go and she's really happy. And I did ask her, because the hurricane's coming, I said, are you high up off the ground a little bit? And she said, oh yeah, we built it high. We're up on a little bluff. I said, good, because I think you have things there. And after reading this book, I thought, oh gosh, there are things there.
There are things there, but see, that's really cool. You'll have to get back to me and tell me where she ended up building the house, because I love the islands that are around, the sea islands that are around the coast of South Carolina and going down into Georgia and everything like that. Some of the islands that have inspired me, and why the town where Not What She Seems is set is closer to the coast. It's like around like where the Charleston area is. And I just love that area all together, and being along, they're so pretty there and everything. So you definitely have to go visit her when there isn't a hurricane happening or a tropical storm happening around here.
Yeah, because as you write in the book, there are things in the night.
Yes.
These places. And of course, lay the background here for the Brodies. What do you want to tell the story? Because there's a lot of intrigue. There's a lot of twists and turns. And it's a little bit of a cautionary story from the point of view of young women who go to college and who you should not fool around with.
Be careful of the decisions that you make.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Jack is a little bit reckless. And you're right. It is a cautionary tale. It is a tale about wearing masks and how people put themselves out in how they want you to see them. But like when they're alone and there's no one around, they take the mask off and they could be something totally different. And you aren't ready for that true self of theirs. And it's about family secrets and hidden bodies, literally and figuratively. So there's a whole lot of that going on. But at the core of it, you're right. It is about a young woman who makes one reckless decision after another because she has all of this self-guilt from an incident that happened with her father, and he ended up dying. And so the whole town thinks that she had something to do with his death. And small towns, they're like, oh, this is the wild child. She's always growing up as a wild child, and she doesn't want to conform to our nice Southern polite ways and things like that. And so she internalizes all of these things that everyone says and is, well, maybe I am this way. Maybe I did have something to do with the death of my father. And she doesn't really remember that because it was so traumatic that she's blocked out that memory. So she can't even say to herself or to anyone else, yes, I did, or no, I didn't. She self-exiles and she goes away to finish grad school and to work and to wallow in her self-loathing until she has to come back home because her good old granddad has taken ill, to put it lightly.
Yes, very lightly. So she's, I also love this story. It's a cautionary tale in many ways. One, it's about when you are young and you are in university, you really have to think about what you're doing with your future when you just get off the right path. It's also a cautionary story in a way about authors, because there is, you know, of the publishing world, it's a cutthroat business. We like to think that all authors are just sweet as apple pie, but it comes down also to the fact that it's a business. And in any business, it doesn't matter what business, there are people who will do anything to get ahead, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
So you bring it all together. You bring it all together. Oh, wow. I love it. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. It is definitely about who you can trust, who you can talk to, and like really put your trust in. Don't trust blindly. And also, you know, keep your business to yourself. Because, yes, you're right. It is a cutthroat business. And while that hasn't happened to me where, you know, someone might take something that is mine or whatever, you know, I know that it's out there and it's happened and who should tell that kind of story. But that all goes in with Jack's character and that she's looking for someone to accept her. And she looks in the wrong place until she finally has to really take a good look at herself and she sees that she sees someone else when she goes back home for who that person really is. But no one else can see this person. They think that this person is like perfect and rich and is a town benefactor, but she's the only one who sees them. But with all of her baggage, basically like the girl who cried wolf, that's how they see her. Nobody wants to believe that she is right and that this person is bad. So it's definitely, it's a cautionary tale about all of these things, about really sticking through to with what your beliefs are and trying to save yourself and save the people that you care for, revenge, like for those who have been hurt by certain people. So I'm not telling anyone to go take revenge on anyone. Please don't do that. And then come back and tell me that I made you do it. But I'm saying like standing up for yourself, I think finally is really what it is. Her finally, hopefully standing up for herself and making the right decisions that she needs to for herself and for her family.
Thinking about it, really, I would give this book to any girl who's about to go to university in September. I'd read this book. It'll just set your mind straight on what you have to think about. Because it's this part, when you start the story with both the prologue and then when we get into this first part of the story, I just got a kick out of it. When we're in the town of Brookhaven. Now, did you grow up in a little town like this?
So I grew up in Northern Virginia. So it was a little town, but then it was right outside of like the DC metro area. So it's not really a little town, if that makes any sense. So not really. It was when I finally moved to South Carolina, then I could really see all the little towns, and all the towns are different, but then they're all the same in that everyone is so pleasant and they smile even though they don't know you, and they ask you about your day and all of these things, and they say bless your heart when you think that, oh, that's so sweet that they're doing that, but it's not as sweet as they mean it sometimes when they're talking to you. It's the whole small town aspect and the idyllic way that towns look here. They're so pretty and stuff. And I'm a thriller writer, so I'm always thinking what it's like in real life, like beneath all of this pretty town and these pretty smiles and all of that. I bet you that there's some really shady things going on with these people. And so that's really what I started thinking, is like something's up with these people, because they can't all be perfect and nice looking and smiling, and they can't all really want to know like how I am and stuff like that. So
yeah, although it is set in the South. I think, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's a universal thing, I think, that happens in small towns. Everybody knows your business, or everybody wants to know your business, and everybody's happy to talk about your business.
Absolutely, and then smile in your face when you walk by, right?
Oh, yeah. I come from a small town, too, and it's, you know, we don't have any alligators or snakes or anything creepy crawly, except the creepy crawly nature of some people, right? Did you have fun trying to capture that feeling of the South?
I did. I really did. I have just taken from my own experience in dealing with people. And like I said, in thinking about, you're really nice outwardly, but how are you deep down inside? Brookhaven, the town, is a fake town that I made because I didn't want anybody to get mad if I used an actual town. But in that town of Brookhaven, I really wanted to make an effort to really make the people who are in that town big, you know what I'm saying? And to really show all of the different characteristics that I have seen, but on a bigger nature. And even with Jack's mother being like perfect Southern lady who wants her daughters to also be perfect Southern ladies and marry well and be in debutante balls and things like that. And living in a town where, like you said, everybody knows your business. You can't run from anything. And they talk about you behind your back and stuff like that. And so I just really wanted to just build upon that and then make the characters that are in there like really big, and like any actions that are happening in there are always like shrouded in, like you said, the creepy crawly at night, being in the woods and being in the swamp, because there are like marshy areas. They're in the low country. There could be marshes, there could be alligators, like you said, that would just come up out of the swamp or out of someone's pool, because the alligators just like to be wherever they want to be, and other things like that. So I really, so even in the setting, can be very pretty in the day and then very scary at night. So I really wanted to play on those two differences.
I think you accomplished that. The scary parts are scary.
Yes.
And I hate anything that goes making sounds in the night. So yes, that you accomplished that. And of course, Jack, you get so mad at her sometimes. I get so mad at her. I can say, oh, don't do that, or don't go there. And that started right from the beginning, where she got involved in something she shouldn't have gotten involved in. But I did have in the back of my mind a little bit of Nina Knight when she did get some ideas of revenge in her head. But did you have, now when you're writing, I think you're the kind of writer who, I don't know if you see it full-blown in your head. I know that with the Knight series, that is such a cinematic series, and I've heard that it's been optioned already, which I think anybody who started the Nina Knight series from book one, we knew that it would be eventually on streaming, because it is so cinematic. Now, this is supposed to be a one-off, right?
Yeah.
But as I said, because I think there's so much still to be done, still to be answered. I'm not done with this book. I'm not done with it. I'm insisting on Montavious. If you had a prequel, to get a television movie for one book, it's not so easy. But if you had a prequel, if we had Montavious, the backstory, I think you could build this into another little gem of an idea. 6-part streaming series.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also think that there's still more to be done. There's not even the villain in the story. I think that her story isn't like complete either. And definitely Montavious. I always, even when I was writing him, I envisioned him like a Columbo. I don't know if you've ever watched that show, but like,
oh,
that's
yeah,
one of
I
my
did.
Favorite
and,
shows. Yeah.
And I did. And I thought, I think he's. It's crazy. I know that Jack is great, but I want more of him. And you're so good at writing him. He's part of you.
Yes. Thank you. I needed someone to counter Jack, because I know that Jack, just like you said, you would talk to her and tell her, don't make that decision, whatever. She is someone who makes some reckless decisions, all in her trying to, like the guilt that she feels and trying to punish herself and things like that. She knows that she's making reckless decisions, but she just goes forth. That is also something in terms of like mother-daughter relationships, because sometimes you do need, and not even mother-daughter, but elder or mentor-mentee relationships, you need sometimes the older people who have lived and had experiences to tell you, hey, that's not the best decision that you're making. But sometimes we, or the younger generation, think that they know everything and they want to just do it, and we have to sit back and let them fail and hopefully fail forward and grow from that. So there are a lot of that, and definitely Montavious has taken her under his wing, right, and was trying to teach her in the way of the detective, and he saw that in her. And so when she goes through those adversities with him and also with her father, that just throws her back a whole lot, because those are two people who she really leaned on and were propelling her forward and giving her that affirmation that, hey, you're not the wild Brody kid. You've got these things and you've got talents and stuff like that. And so she, in the story, you see her start to trust herself more and rely on what Montavious and her dad taught her in terms of being a detective, in terms of investigating, in terms of going after the bad guy, essentially. And so she uses her talent. Now, she's not an assassin like Nina, and Nina has a different set of skills. She has a different toolbox from which she pulls, but Jack starts to use her own toolbox as a research assistant, going into the same, on the same computer that her grandfather was using with his little armchair detective with cold cases and stuff. And so she's also doing the same thing and utilizing those skills that he has taught her all of these years. So yes, she and Nina are the same in that both of them really go, they really want to protect the people that they care for. And they also utilize the tools that they have. And so that's why Jack is very also different from Nina, because Nina, we know she's gonna win because she knows how to fight. She knows how to use a gun. She knows how to use blades, all of that stuff. But how is Jack gonna win? And so she goes for what she knows that she knows how to use, and she goes that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is just from this point of view of looking at the whole story of where she can go, and then looking at Montavious. And what I love, now I know you came at a young age. Your parents came to America. You came from Ghana. How old were you?
So I was born here.
You were born here. Okay.
Yeah, I was born here. But when my parents, so my parents came to go to college, and then they had me. And then when they had me, they sent me back to Ghana to live with my grandmother for a time while they finished school and everything, and then brought me back. So I was here, and then I was there, and then I was back here.
So how old were you when you came back?
So when I came back, I was maybe about 3 or so, and then I've been back since 1 or 2 times with my father when he was still here. But yeah, so I've been here officially, I guess, since I was like 2-3 years old.
So now, so you didn't have a grandfather like Montavious living with you?
No, unfortunately, I didn't.
You made up a wonderful grandfather. He's everybody's grandfather.
Yes, I want him. Yes, I called upon all of my experiences with my husband's grandfather and the males in his family who are like father figures to me. And I think I also just included like what my ideal granddad would be like. He would be this like rough tumble guy. And so I just channeled my inner granddad.
Yeah, you captured him, because I of course thought of my granddad, and I was thinking, because he was so mentally alert, he never missed a beat. He was 99 years old when he passed away. But he was as sharp as anything, and how much he would have loved to have a computer and to be able to do exactly that, reach out to do the research, because he always wanted to know things. He was always curious. And I think a lot of my curiosity comes from just him always asking. I remember walking with him. He was a farmer. But he was the one who was asking, why is the sky blue? Why is this? He's asking me these things. And I realized afterwards he was trying to get me to talk and to express myself. But he did this constantly, and I loved it. And I look back and I think, oh, if only he would have had a computer. He could have done this searching. He would have loved it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And there are so many seniors out there who are vital, and they love being able to go on the World Wide Net and do research and read and just keep their minds active.
Yep, you're right. You're absolutely right.
I think Not What She Seems is a fascinating book, and you will fall in love from the prologue on. You'll just say, I need to know more about the entire Brody family and, of course, this Low Country world, which is quite different. We'll just mention a little bit about Moor Manor.
Yeah, Moor Manor, which they call Murder Manor, is this really huge southern style home. And it's been in this town for a long time, and it's had a very shady past with a lot of killing and stuff like that. And Faye Arden, she comes in and she is trying to renovate it and make it into a bed and breakfast, a country inn, so that they can have visitors come to the town and stuff like that. And to Jack, it's always, and the younger kids that are in Brookhaven, it's always called Murder Manor because of all the murder that has happened in it, but it's officially Moor Manor. So it is like the big main setting of the story. It's always looming in the background with all of its stories, and all of its hidden passages and things like that. So it's very much always on Jack's mind, and it's like a character itself in the story, in the book.
I will let people read the book and discover more about Moore Manor. The book is called Not What She Seems, but I am not going to let Yasmin go yet, because Yasmin, we have to talk about Nina Knight and the series. There are three books so far. Her name is Knight, I think, and I can't remember the second one.
They come at night. And then it ends with Knight.
Once you finish your deal, you'll be writing more of these, because they're just, when you create a character, isn't it wonderful how you can create a character in your head and then they seem so real, or they are so real because actually Nina's in there somewhere waiting to come out again?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It takes me a while to even start writing a story because I really want to know the character and know how the character is going to be. Before I wrote Nina, before I even wrote Jack, and thinking about Jack and Montavia, and then Nina, and the people who are going to be around Nina, I sat and I thought about, who are these people going to be? How is Nina going to behave this whole entire time? What is her personality like? So she is very much real in my mind. It was very hard to put her away a little bit while I wrote something else. But she, because she's real in my mind, she talks to me often. And so she's, that's okay, go ahead and hang out with Jack for a little bit, but don't forget about me. So I'll never forget about her. And hopefully, yeah, you're right. I hopefully can come back to Nina, because I think that there are some prequels and some offshoots from her story that can happen.
Definitely. Of course, it was, I think the minute it came out, it became really acclaimed. I know that it was on Amazon Best Book of the Month, and Editor's Pick, and all sorts of things like that. A lot of notice that you got for that first book, and then, of course, the other ones subsequently, people were waiting for them to come out. And yeah. I know that you received the award at Sisters in Crime for Emerging Writers of Color.
What's the name of that one? Taylor Bland Award. The Eleanor Taylor Bland Award of Emerging Writers of Color.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How did you feel when you heard that you won that?
I felt like it wasn't real, because that was at a time that happened before that I had just gotten an agent, maybe the week before I found out that I won that award. So that was before Nina had, or Her Name is Knight, had a book deal or anything like that. And so it was very surreal, because before then I was getting a lot of rejection for the book before I got my agent. And I really thought that I wasn't going to win the award. I just applied for the award or for the contest, because a friend happened to say, hey, why don't you do this thing? And I was like, I'm not going to win, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway. And so then when I won, I thought, oh my gosh, wow, because Eleanor Taylor Bland was such a prolific writer, a Black woman who's writing crime fiction and like police procedurals and things like that. And I thought that it was such an honor to win an award, you know, named after her. And so I'm hoping, you know, to live up to that honor a little bit by creating characters that really stick with you, characters that you don't normally see, but become like a part of you. And you know that person like you would know someone who lives next door to you. Creating stories that really stick with you as well after you've finished reading. That was something that I think about and I try to live up to with the stories that I tell. I try to make them all as cinematic as I can, because you had asked me before if a story like plays out in my head, and it does play out in my head, just a movie. I have to have it play out from beginning to end. While I don't plot too much, but I have it play out in my head before I start writing it. So I see everything and figure out how it's going to be before I actually start like typing on the computer.
It's fantastic what you've accomplished. Now, you mentioned you were getting an agent. So how did you get an agent? Because that's not easy either.
Yeah, no, that's super hard. So I got an agent through querying, sending email to, I can't even tell you how many agents, over 100 agents, and looking at their wish list of what they wanted, what they were interested in. And so I sent it to Melissa, my agent, and it took her a few months, I think, to get back to me. So when I did hear from her, this was after over 100 rejections for Nina Knight alone. And when I did hear from her, I couldn't even believe. I was like, is she really wanting to offer me representation, or does she want to talk to me because she wants to tell me how bad my book is? I don't know. So I was very scared before we had a phone conversation. But finally, we spoke, and she offered representation, and I couldn't believe it, that I had finally achieved this thing. It's super hard to query and to put yourself out there. You have to believe in yourself. If no one else will believe in you, you believe in you, and that's what I kept telling myself. I'm going to believe in me, despite everyone telling me, oh, the book is good, but I'm going to believe in me, and I think that's what kept me going through all of those rejections.
Did you have a number of iterations of your query letter? Because the query letter is a daunting task.
It is. It is very much. I had several iterations because every time that I was emailing or reaching out to a specific agent, I would tailor it to that agent. Whenever I was getting rejections back, I would always be revising it because I'm like, okay, maybe I didn't sell the book well enough this way. So I'm tweaking lines and stuff like that. I'm always tweaking, but there's so many reiterations. I don't even, whatever it is that I sent to Melissa and it worked, and I'm like, thank goodness. I'm not the best at query letters or summaries or anything like that. So that's not how I sell myself. And I already knew that I wasn't the best at that. So that was going to be daunting. So the fact that the book has to speak for itself, even though the query letter might not be the best. And I think that for anyone who's out there who's querying, your query letter, yes, is the first thing that they'll see and that will capture them. But ultimately, it is your book, your first few pages, that's going to really catch the agent. And so that's what I really leaned on and tried to say, okay, this is what's going to sell it for me is the book, not necessarily the letter.
Yeah, because I think, of course, when you do the query letter, did they first want 10 pages or did she take the whole manuscript? Because I think sometimes it's scary that they're only going to take a few pages. That's your life in those few pages.
Exactly. And you have to make them so perfect and stuff. It's a lot in those few pages. And that's daunting as well. That's a good question. No, it wasn't just 10 pages. I want to say that she may have asked for 50 pages. So 50 pages is a little safer, right? Because you can get to the story real well in those 50 pages. You should be getting to the story real well. So I think hers was 50 pages. But you're right. The 10 pages are very hard. And you have to be really perfect on those 10 pages. So yeah, if they ask for a little bit more, that's even better.
Yeah, I think it's better. I think the idea of the 10 pages just, it makes my stomach, just the idea of it. But of course, in this case, I think we start in not what she seems. You start with just Montavious Brody Sr. And I just... Mm-hmm. Right away, I was intrigued. I had to know more about just with the name. And I don't remember the first line of her name is Knight. I can't remember that one at the moment. Do you remember all your first lines of each of your books
nope.
now? No?
Nope.
It's so funny.
You, I don't know.
It's so funny. I talked to Mary Higgins Clark many times. And so one of the times, I just for fun, I in my opening to her, I used three lines of her first lines of her book. It made sense to use them. And then I realized she didn't know those lines. She couldn't remember that she had written them. But of course, by then she was on her 54th book and they were from books like 7 and 11. I don't remember so one of the other numbers. And she couldn't remember them. She said, did I write that? I said, yes, you did. Oh, she said, I must have struggled over that one.
I know that's right. Yes, me too. So I'm just like her. I can't remember them. And sometimes I don't even remember certain characters. And then I have to be reminded. So I often get surprised if someone reads something back to me and I'm like, I wrote that? Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it makes you feel really good. And
yeah.
Particularly if you read it and you say, wow, when was I that good?
Exactly.
Isn't it a wonderful feeling?
Well, yeah, that's actually it is. Yeah,
it is. And that's why I call this program Joy on Paper, because you get such, of course, it's partly the joy of reading, but it's also when you're writing and you see those words and they pop out at you and you say, oh, wow. Oh, wow. I can really do this.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Now, of course, for both of these, for the Nina Knight series, and you remember getting, nowadays, I think it's not as much fun. You don't get checks like in the old days where people used to get checks, and now they just transfer the money in your bank account. But you remember that feeling of the first money you got for Nina?
Yeah, when the first job came in, yes, I remember it, and I was like, oh my gosh, I had to like just kind of stare at it a little bit and just make sure that it was real, you know, because it was a good feeling. I guess that maybe made it a little bit more real for me in that, okay, so they've given me like one of the installment payments. And so now
it's real.
Yeah, it's real. And then also now I've got to start this next book too. So yeah, like it was great. It's a great feeling. You're right. They don't send the paper checks anymore, but when that deposit hits that, and you get that little notification on your phone. Oh yeah, that's great.
Oh, that's a good feeling. That's a good feeling. And of course, you're going to have a lot of those feelings as the money's pouring in for all of this now. And that's wonderful. I think it's amazing what you've accomplished. And it is part of so many things of determination, as you said, not giving up. The first book, how long did it take you to write that one?
When I actually sat down and started writing it, it took me about a year and a half. I started in 2018, but I had been thinking about the character of Nina since right after my father passed away. And then I started really thinking about the character of Nina and what I wanted her to do. But I was also teaching and raising kids at that time, so I couldn't really invest my time in writing her just yet. So it was 2018 that I was like, okay, now I'm going to do it. And I started mapping it out a little bit more. 2019 is when I was like, this year I'm going to finish it, because at the top of 2020, I'm going to start querying her and trying to get her published traditionally, because I knew that I couldn't do it self-publishing. I bowed my head to all the independent authors and self-published authors that are out there, because how they do it, I don't even know. I'm horrible at marketing, like I said, with my query letter and all that. So yeah, 2019 is when I just took it out. I just was like, in between work and everything, I'm like, I'm going to write this thing, was writing it, and then started querying it at January 2020. Wow.
I want to thank you so much, Yasmin, for being on Joy on Paper today. It's Yasmin Engo. And do you have a website where people can find you?
Yes, you can find me at yasminongo.com or on IG at author_yasminongo. Yep, you can see me. I'm here.
And you spell it A-N-G-O-E, Engo.
Yes.
And thank you again for being on Joy on Paper. You are a joy.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. Thank you for having me. I had fun.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Wow. Bye-bye now.